The Choose Love movement offers no-cost solutions that keep our kids safe, providing them with the skills and tools they need to flourish. Join us in our mission to create the world we want to live in, one that's connected and compassionate. Check us out at ChooseLoveMovement.org. Together, we can choose love.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Choose Love podcast. Today, I have an incredibly special guest. In fact, I have to admit, like, I'm usually not nervous, but I'm a little nervous because I have Angela Duckworth here with me today. I'm so excited to have her. I've read her book three times.
What?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, I read it twice and then I listened to it once. But Angela is an academic and psychologist focusing on achievement. She's a researcher and author of Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. She is co-founder of Character Lab, a nonprofit whose mission is to advance scientific insights that help children thrive. She's also the Rosa Lee and Egbert Chang Professor at the University of Pennsylvania and faculty co-director of the Penn Wharton Behavior Change for Good Initiative. Her podcast, No Stupid Questions, is part of the Freakonomics Radio family. Welcome to Choose Love, Angela.
Thank you, Scarlett. I'm so happy to be here in conversation.
Thank you so much. So, I'm going to get into my personal story and how grit relates to that soon. But I just, you know, wanted to talk about your research and your personal reasons for getting into this whole topic of grit. You found in your research that grit equals passion and perseverance. It's the title of your book. And your goal, you've said, is to use psychological science to help kids achieve and thrive. And it's kind of interesting why I know why I do what I do. I'm curious as to how you got to be focused and gritty about what your purpose and passion is in life.
I think there are two major life experiences that led me to have a, you know, real sense of calling, I guess, about my work. The earliest and the first of those would be my father. I mean, I have to roll my eyes because, like, my father really was so single-mindedly obsessed with achievement, his own achievement, our achievement as children, you know, the achievement of my cousins who lived in Boston, who were always held up to my brother, my sister, and me as, you know, being higher achievers than we were. So that would be a pretty common topic at the dinner table. And just, he was obsessed with, like, oh, you know, achievement in anything. It's like the Olympics, who won the Nobel Prize this year? You know, who was the greatest physicist in history? That was my dad. And my experience from that was that achievement was the most interesting and important thing. And it was also probably, like, for me, like, well, that's the way to get my dad to love me, you know, and pay attention to me. Because if you weren't really achieving something, he really wasn't paying attention to you. So that was the first experience. The second experience was, I was a classroom teacher for, you know, about half a decade. I had done a lot of tutoring with kids for, like, maybe, I guess, another half decade, if you add it all up. So in that time with kids, you know, most of whom were growing up with very few opportunities. What I saw in my classroom as a teacher, and then before that as a tutor or a big sister, as a volunteer, were these just huge differences in how people's lives were turning out. And it didn't take a social scientist to just see the trajectories that kids were on. And I began to wonder, you know, why there were these very, very different life outcomes when you sit next to these kids. Like, yes, some of them are more mathematically talented or artistically talented, but they're all so smart. I mean, kids have beautiful young minds. And as any of us who are, you know, able to spend some time with young people, you realize they're all bright. They're all smart. So it led me then to the question is, if achievement is, you know, the thing that we should all be thinking about, and if the answer of talent, something my dad talked about a lot, is incomplete, Like, it cannot be the full explanation for these kids' outcomes because they were all pretty smart. Then it leaves you to the next question. And that's what I think turned me into a psychologist. I was like, oh, there's got to be something to effort here. There's got to be something to sticking with something that is hard and sticking through it long enough to get somewhere. So that's kind of how I grew up to eventually become a psychologist. And it is still very, personally meaningful to me. And you know, one of the reasons why I'm happy to, you know, talk about that and learn from your experience as well.
Yeah, because it's like every child has the capacity for being the best version of themselves and for so much more than some of them reach. And so, you know, my focus has been, how do we help kids connect? Obviously, we know that connection is so important. And we all want to love and be loved. Jesse wrote this beautiful message on our kitchen chalkboard shortly before his murder at Sandy Hook Elementary School that I found afterwards, nurturing healing love. And I thought, wow, you know, emotional wellness is all about feeling better, the ability to be able to feel better. That's how I describe it. And I saw that message and I thought, this is the solution. Because while everybody else is focusing on the problem, I saw that very few are focusing on the root cause of the suffering that led eventually to that attack. And I thought, wow, looking at the pathway to violence, it starts with a grievance usually, and then it escalates up through ideation, preparation into attack. And I thought, wow, what we usually do in our society with big societal issues is we're reactive, we focus on the negative, so we focus on the attack end, and we harden schools, we have active shooter drills, and I'm not against that. But what I knew from my own experience was that Sandy Hook had all of those things in place, but what they were missing was addressing the root cause, which is the pain. And by the way, that's another really powerful connector that we have. It is something that is innate in the human experience. We've all felt physical, mental, and emotional pain. We know that our kids are going to, and, you know, it's my belief that it is our responsibility to give them the skills, tools, and awarenesses they need to not just manage the pain, but to be able to learn from it, grow through it, and be strengthened by it. Wow. Post-traumatic growth. Can you imagine a generation that knows that there is a purpose behind pain? Okay, I'm in this painful experience. It doesn't really take away the pain, this understanding and knowledge, but it takes away some of the fear of the experience. And fear exacerbates pain and inhibits healing. So this is just a little bit about my thought process.
Yeah.
And what, by the way, the really extensive programming that we have put out in the world at no cost, pre-K through 12th grade for homes, communities, foster care. Now we have a Choose Love for Corrections program. And it's all based on this really, really powerful formula for being able to return your locus of control inside yourself, take your personal power back, and be able to thoughtfully respond with love in every situation, circumstance, or interaction. And love, of course, is always the most powerful response. And so, you know, that's why I think your book just was so meaningful to me. I didn't read it until after the tragedy, unfortunately, but that grit really is been what's driving me. It describes me after the tragedy, just this hardworking and diligent, determined effort to be part of the solution, because I know what happened was 100% preventable. And not many people say that. I know it was, having lived through it and experienced it and researched it. I know that all of the ones that are happening now are preventable. And I just wanted to be part of the solution. I knew I had to take responsibility for what happened in order to be part of the solution. And I feel so grateful for doing that. It's funny because you talk about the starting point of this at home with a painful experience as well, really. And that was your dad. And your dad would say that you're no genius, Angela, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You mentioned that in your book. And I bet now you can look back and I don't know if you've gotten to this point yet, but be grateful for that experience because, wow,
also,
look, it propelled
and generous.
You.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Scarlett, like, be grateful for it, right? How do we turn anything that happens to us into some form of a growth experience? And also to be generous. Like, I think that, you know, if I truly try to understand my, you know, my own dad, like, he also had, like, a story. And, you know, his own father, I think he told me he only spoke to his father in a conversation like this, in a conversation that would last as long as we're talking. I think he said 5 times in his life. Like, wow. I was like, oh, that's not so great. Well, that explains a lot. I wanted to say something about, as you were narrating about Choose Love and, you know, the mission of it and the purpose of it. So in my studies on grit, well, around the time that I was really getting deep into grit, I met a young woman named Lauren, Lauren Esquist Winkler, and she showed up on my doorstep as a graduate student. She is now actually all grown up, and she's a professor at Kellogg, the business school at Northwestern. But when we just started talking about what she would study, she said, you know, I want to study survivor mission. And I said, what's that? She's like, well, you've heard of survivor guilt. And I was like, I have heard of survivor guilt. I'm not somebody who's like an expert in, you know, post-traumatic growth or anything that is in that category. And she said, you know, I think she was speaking, you know, in part from her own personal experience. She was like, I think there is actually a way that you can survive something which is traumatic and come out of it with a sense of purpose, like a sense of meaning. So what she did was a couple of studies, if I remember correctly. I think there were several hundred people who had been victims of crimes. I mean, she was basically looking at who becomes a detective, right? And what she found was that if you just survey, I think, and now you'll forgive me for it's, I think, been more than 10 years since she did this study. But I think what you'll find is that a lot of people are drawn to their work, detectives in this case, because they had been a victim of a crime and now are finding some purpose and meaning in preventing that from happening to other people. And mm-hmm. then the other study that she had done was, I think, people who had been drawn to therapy, you know, as clinicians, who, you know, had, you know, something happened to them or an episode in their lives. Mm-hmm. So I guess I just wanted to say that as you were talking, I was like, you know, the sense of mission and purpose, nobody would wish a tragedy on anyone. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that motivates a sense of survivor mission is you do see an element of this tragedy that the rest of the world is blind to. And then you feel like if you don't do something, because you can see a problem that others are blind to, like, I think that's what gives you, you know, a sense of calling to bring yourself to it. And I don't know whether that resonates with you, but I think that's, you know, a connection as you were talking that clicked for me.
Yeah, interesting. So I can see, I'm actually looking at it in a different way. So yeah. After the tragedy, I saw so many people, first of all, polarized, you know, taking one side or another.
Polarized? Wait, what?
I know, right? But
I'm actually having a hard time. Like, what's the other pole?
Oh, well, I, you know, at the time, it was pro-gun, anti-gun. That was the big controversy then, right?
Yeah.
About the shooting. And it was a sole focus on the gun.
Which is,
instrument. So it was either pro or against. And I remember thinking, wow, that type of polarization is never going to result in a solution because we have to work together and agree. So that's one of the reasons I started the Choose Love movement based on Jesse's message, but he gave me the idea because we can all agree that we want and need love, and that without love, connection, belonging, that we suffer. So there's got to be a place where everyone can come together to be part of the
solution. And you felt like there is not, you know, there's like agreement, there is unity, because everybody understands that, everyone experiences that, as opposed to you were thinking this gun issue is not a soluble conflict in this country at this historical moment, I assume.
Well, you know what, Angela? I started looking at how we've dealt with big societal issues in the past. I looked at how successful all of our attempts have been since the war on drugs. And of course, yeah. That is wah, wah.
Yes. Not going so
right?
Far. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that the thing is, I started looking at all these anti movements, and it's like anti, and then whatever the problem is. And I'm thinking, wow, so I don't want to spend the rest of my life fighting against something.
Yeah. Fighting the negative. You're like,
fighting
how
the
about
negative?
We,
like, yeah. These people are angry, and I literally wanted to have joy. I had joy before. Jesse left a message for his older brother that said, have a lot of fun. We had so much fun. I was a single mom with two boys. I wanted to have joy, awe, and wonder in my life. And I thought, I can't have it fighting against something, but I can have it being for spending the rest of my life for. Plus, I had a 12-year-old son. I wanted to model for him how to move. It was only me.
Yeah.
Model for him how to move through this tragedy with as much strength and grace in the best way possible, because I knew that he was learning. And you say that actually in your book, that kids don't, if they don't really listen to what you're saying, they definitely look at what you're doing. And I saw him looking at me. I was the person that he was, the only person in his life that he was looking to. And that helped me. That alone helped me rise to the occasion, because I was like, wow, I'm teaching him in the moment. I have to be the best version of myself. How do I want him to handle something like this in the future? How do I want him to face challenges for the rest of his life? I'm going to be that person that he can see doing that.
So it made you better, right?
It made me much better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Strength.
I will just say, you know, on behalf of like all of psychology, I don't know that there's another species on the planet that models the way human beings do. So, you know, we are the only animal that truly learns from each other in the way that we see somebody doing something. We understand it. We also can understand why they do it. And then we do it, right? And some have argued that that is what makes us different. Like, you know, there's lots of arguments about what makes the human species so special. But the modeling to me is the most foundational kind of learning there is. Babies model before they can talk. Like, so I do think one of the interesting aspects of this is if you really lean into it, you find that you are a better person when you have this conscious awareness.
Yes.
Because you're modeling whether it's intentional or not, but I have found the same, you know, if I have to stand around and say like, oh, I, you know, like believe in character, or like I believe, you know, in grace or in grit, like then I sort of have to, you know, walk the talk.
That's right. You've made a bold statement, Angela.
It's out there. I can't take it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you have certainly modeled that. That's for sure. And you actually did cite a study in your book as well that talked about, it was a situation where, for modeling, where a child and an adult would be in a room. And I think the adult would be like abusing some type of
something. Yeah, I can tell you a little bit about the Bobo doll study, which is what called, or the nickname for it, but also very new research that just came out that is like kind of an extension of it. So the Bobo doll study that you're talking about, Scarlett, is from Stanford University and Professor Al Bandura, who had the suspicion, he had the strong intuition that we model in other words, like that we learn this way. Now, it's common sense, I think, to most of us, but at the time it was like behaviorism. So people thought you only learn from punishment and reward. And I say people meaning like psychologists, or that was the received wisdom. And he just said, that makes no sense. We also learn when we just see somebody do something without punishment or reward, just seeing them do it. So he did this study where there's an inflatable doll, the Bobo doll, and adults basically in the experimental condition, they like beat up on this doll. Mm-hmm. In the control condition, they don't. Mm-hmm. And these children are just watching through this window in the laboratory at Stanford. And when you let them into the room, which has, by the way, lots of toys, you know, not just this inflatable doll, but lots of toys, the children who previously watched an adult beat up on this doll for a few minutes, they like walk over to the doll immediately and they start pounding it and kicking it and punching it. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at the children who did not experience that modeling, they do nothing of the kind. And that was the first rigorous scientific evidence of what is, I think, common sense to many parents and others, which is that, of course, when you're kind, like when the mailman comes and rings the doorbell, and how you speak to that mailman, is it with kindness? Mm-hmm. Is it with respect mm-hmm. or not? Oh my gosh, your kids are modeling that immediately, oh, yeah. right? Exactly. And, yes. you know, so it's in a way common sense, but I wanted to tell you about a very recent study that is less well known. It was done at Yale University, or it was done by Julia Leonard, who's now at Yale University. She's a child psychologist, and she asked the question. So she knew that modeling worked. In fact, in her own studies, she showed that little kids, I mean, really little babies who still need a high chair, they also model. So if you're trying to like open a jar or open a toy and it's like really, really hard, if you model that, then afterwards you give the baby a very difficult puzzle and they will try harder and longer. Wow. So that was, you know, a replication. Right. But here's what she found, I think is good advice for those of us who would like to be more intentional role models. Yeah. She ran a condition where the adult struggles and models grit. And also says things like, oh gosh, this is really hard. But you know what? You do things that are hard and you keep trying, right? Mm-hmm. Like you basically like closed captioning the take-home message. And what she found was that adults who augmented their modeling with verbal statements that basically were like, in case you missed it, like this is the take home. In that condition, the children persisted the most. They were the grittiest. So I think what it says to us is that modeling is very important. Children don't need to be taught to model. They do it spontaneously. And you can kind of boost the modeling effect. Most coaches that I study, like high school track and football coaches, the ones that are really great, like some athletes will tell me, they're like, oh yeah, coach likes to give commercials. I was like, what's a commercial? They're like, well, you know, he's always modeling character, kindness, you know, responsibility, grit. But then he gives his commercials where he like tells us like why he did a certain thing or like what's important. So I think that research is both practical, and illuminating. And I've since been trying to close caption, you know, when I'm around young people too. So that when you answer the door and the postman comes and, you know, you try to be kind, of course, you try to be respectful, but then you might add a little closed caption about like, you know, like sometimes when I answer the door and I'm being interrupted, I kind of don't really feel like being nice, but then mm-hmm. I remember that it's better to be kind, and probably the mailman has had a really long day. And if I'm cranky, it will make it a longer day. So that's the kind of closed captioning I think that Julia Leonard at Yale is studying, and maybe that we could all try to do in the way that we can, in the way that we, you know, see that we can do.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And I mean, sometimes we use an excuse to say, I've just had a hard day and I'm shutting down, you know, but that's when we really need to step up. And I think that what you're saying is great advice for me personally, but also for all our educators and parents that are listening. You talk about in the book that optimistic teachers are grittier and happier and get their students to achieve more. So, you know, what you're talking about is modeling this optimism and grittiness, but that results in students achieving more and in so many different ways. And of course, happiness is in there too, which we all want.
Yeah. And, you know, optimism is something that my PhD advisor studied, as you know, since you're very well read. But I'll just say that Marty Seligman was my PhD advisor, very important mentor to me. I often tell him that he is my second father. And by the way, the two fathers have a lot in common, and they're both obsessed with achievement. And Marty, I'll say when he was a very young psychologist, it was like, I mean, among the first studies he ever ran was he was looking at these animals, and this is now going back decades, and he was looking to see which ones were gritty. I mean, which ones were resilient in the face of adversity. So there would be these experiments where dogs would be like, you know, I mean, you have to cover your ears if you're a real dog lover. But they would be like in these experiments where like they would experience some mild but painful and very scary electric shock through the bottom of the cage. And when you have a dog in this cage where like anything they do doesn't turn off the shock, it just teaches them to be helpless. Marty would call that learned pessimism. Like you just learn that pretty much anything you do, the world is going to suck, right? But then what he found was there were some dogs who did not learn that lesson. And no matter what happened, they remained optimistic. They kept trying. They kept trying to escape the shock. They kept trying to make their situations better. Now, Marty did grow up to be a dog lover and continued to be a psychologist. And in his development, I think what he came to be very interested in is like, what is optimism, right? Like he began to study people and he found that optimistic people, they are grittier and they're also happier, as you mentioned, Scarlett. So, mm-hmm. So really what's going on, I think Marty would say, he's now 80 something. I went to his 80th birthday.
I spoke to him about a year ago.
Okay, so he was probably over 80 then, and you surely talked about these experiments, right? Because this is his seminal work. I mean, I will say that my understanding of optimism, which is very related to growth mindset, is mm-hmm. I think it is, you know, you say choose love, right? Like there mm-hmm. is a kind of like, you know, without denying that there's a lot we can't change, I choose to focus my attention on what I can change. Mm-hmm. That to me is really at the bottom of optimism. It's not like, oh, being in a good mood all the time. I think it's not like having a sunny temperament. I think it's a choice. I think it's an active choice to choose to pay attention to what you can change and not to allow yourself to be drawn into the vortex of thinking about all of the things. And there are a lot of things that you can't change. So to right. me, that's the core of it. And that is why, you know, these optimistic people that Marty has studied and that sometimes I study with him, you know, I think that is why they are happier. I don't always remember that lesson. I sometimes wake up and think about all the things I can't change and all the things that are ruined and mm-hmm. everything that happened in the past that I wish didn't happen. And I get stuck in a regret loop. But then I do try to, you know, draw my attention to, I mean, in my class of undergraduates, I assign them this task called the 5-minute favor. So we talk about learned helplessness. We talk about optimism. We talk about how you can draw your attention to things you can't change, or you can draw your attention to things that you can. Mm-hmm. And then they have to think of a 5-minute favor. A 5-minute favor is a tiny little thing. It's not going to change, you know, big things like the climate or laws, but it's a thing that you can control. So example, 5-minute favors, like, you know, you unload the dishwasher for your roommate. You know, a lot of students like got out their phones and they texted their parents to just to say like, thank you. And that they loved them. A lot of people like thought of like very small things. I said, I will pick up one piece of trash a day. I was like, there's a lot of trash on the ground. I walk by it every day. I can't pick it all up, but I can pick up one thing. I will pick up one thing every day, which I still do. I've learned how to find the right piece of trash to pick up because some of it probably shouldn't pick up. So anyway, I do think optimism, I'm glad you brought it up. I'm glad you talked to Marty.
Yes.
I think that's to me more useful than, I think a lot of people think optimism is just being in a good mood or being sunny, but that's not it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And this whole concept of choice, you know, we teach the kids and educators that you can't always choose what happens to you. And, you know, if I'm speaking, I will hold up myself as an example. Obviously, I would never have chosen what happened to my son. However, I can take my personal power back and how I choose to respond. And, you know, I think ultimately we either respond out of love or fear, ultimately. And of course, choosing love feels good. Anger, hatred, resentment feels bad. So we're in the business of emotional wellness and trying to make people feel better. So we want people to choose love. I ultimately want to create the world that we want to live in, one that's safer, more peaceful and loving and kind. And can you imagine a world filled with people that have the ability? And by the way, Angela, you know, I do a lot of prison work. We have a Choose Love for Corrections program. And these people didn't know they had a choice.
They just say more. How are they thinking about things before you start talking?
Well, they, you know, it is what it is. And they have had been through incredibly harrowing experiences. You know, I always say, I've never met a person that has intentionally harmed another. And I've met a lot of them, by the way. I've spoken to a lot of school shooters as well. I've never met anybody that has intentionally harmed another person that is not coming from a significant point of pain within themselves that is unresolved. And they don't have the skills and tools to resolve it. This happened and I am in pain and I can't deal with it. So it comes out in my behavior and I act out, and that's kids or big kids. Right. And so, you know, it's absolutely amazing. And some of my favorite work, I have to tell you, to, in fact, I'll send you our sizzle reel that we have for the program to go into a prison and to tell my story. First of all, I have credibility. I walk in and, you know, I've lost a child to murder. And so they're listening there anyway. Jesse is really incredible. They can't believe, you know, it's amazing, the nurturing, healing, love sign. But also Jesse stood up to the shooter that came into his first grade classroom. And
that I didn't know.
He is credited with saving 9 of his classmates' lives before losing.
Wow.
Right. He's a you know, 6-year-old little boy in his first grade classroom. And so we believe, you know, he instructed his friends to run. They said that it's because he told them that they ran. And we believe Jesse didn't, because he was staying to keep his teacher safe. And he died standing right in front of her. So, you know, I'm telling this story and I have everyone right here because... Hey. You know, they can't believe it. And the whole point of telling everyone that is to say, look, you have the same courage. You have the same capacity.
Yeah.
Courage that Jesse showed. He was a 6-year-old little boy.
The capacity to be good inside. Right. Yeah.
And I'm not talking about, you know, to stand up to an active shooter. I'm talking about the courage to be kind when someone isn't being kind to you, to do the right thing instead of what's just easy, to pause in between when somebody says something to you and your reaction, and choose love as a thoughtful response. It's always a choice. And so we're teaching kids this, that, you know, in any situation, circumstance, or interaction, you can choose. And we use a powerful formula, and then everything is taught underneath this powerful formula. So the school year is broken up into 4 quarters. The first quarter is talking about courage. And then we teach, of course, growth mindset, all of that beneath it. But it's this overarching umbrella of courage. And that means that everybody in the school talks about courage and how they're using courage. And you can have courage to try a math equation, or, you know, have courage to invite somebody to your table at lunch. Everybody's using this concept of courage. And it's because, and we teach how to strengthen courage. Research says that courage is like a muscle. You can practice it to strengthen it. So we teach them how to strengthen it with brave breaths, with power poses. And we call them brave poses. And other ways. And then the second character value. And I actually want to talk about how I put this into how you talked about growing grit from the inside out. So let me just do it while I'm going through the formula. Let me just tell you how I did it. Okay.
Yeah. I'm listening.
All right. So you talk about growing grit from the inside out. And the first thing that you have to have is really interest in what you're doing.
Hi, my name is Scarlett Lewis. I'm the founder of the Choose Love Movement. I founded this organization following the murder of my 6-year-old son, Jesse, and 27 others at Sandy Hook Elementary School. I realized then that we must come together in order to solve the escalating issues of violence, substance abuse, and mental illness in our country and world. I created the Choose Love Movement because, as humans, we are 99.9% genetically the same. We all need love, and we all also feel pain. We teach all ages how to choose love and grow through pain. It's pretty simple. Love feels good, and anger, hatred, and resentment feel bad. Hurt people hurt people. Even though we can't always choose what happens to us, we can always choose how we respond. Love is always the strongest response. 6-year-old Jesse stood up to the shooter and saved 9 of his classmates' lives before losing his own. We all have the capacity for that courage. Join the Choose Love Movement today and be part of the solution by creating a safer, more peaceful, and loving world. Thank you.
I said, that's courage. That's courage to, you have to have courage to say, you know what, this isn't something that I want to do. And I want to try something new to even figure out what you have passion for, you know, because your parents are pushing you towards one thing, your school is pushing you towards one thing, and to really find what your thing is takes courage. And that's really important, because grit has to do with staying with something
that you enjoy. Yeah.
That you enjoy, but for over time, not just for, you know, the day. So the first thing was the courage to find your interest. And then the second, and you can correct me, is to practice perseverance for mastery. And I was saying that requires gratitude. So gratitude is our second character value. And we, you know, when you practice gratitude, you have to have courage to be grateful for, you know, when things aren't going your way. And we use it as the great mind shifter. So, you know, you talked earlier about how Even Angela Duckworth says sometimes focuses on negative stuff.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yes. Because that's the way our brains are wired, right?
We falter. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely.
So we use gratitude as this great mind shifter. So when you're going down a negative path, you can think of something that you're grateful for, and it literally shifts the focus of your lens.
The positive.
The positive. And it also fortifies you from the inside out to strengthen you for that perseverance to master what you're interested in, because you've got to stick with it. You want to stick with it with strength and grace, and gratitude helps you do that. And then you have purpose. You have to have it has to have like a deeper purpose. You can't just be doing it for no reason. You have to have
greater than yourself. I think that's
something right for service, something outside greater than yourself. There has to be a significant amount of meaning in it as well. And I talk about that as compassion in action. Now I'm going a little bit out of order, but compassion in action, because I say that compassion is the identification of a need in yourself or someone else. Mm-hmm. And then the action component that you do to help with that need, either in yourself or someone else. And I use not just compassion, but compassion in action.
Yeah, that's great.
I really wanted to focus on that action component.
Doing something. Yeah.
Not just thinking about it.
But and not just feeling, right?
Not just feeling it, but literally having the courage. Here's that courage again. That's our first character value. To be able to step outside of maybe your we're all so distracted, we're busy, but we all also have some pain and suffering to some degree. And you know, especially when you're feeling lonely or anxious, That is the hardest time to step outside yourself and do something for someone else. But it's the
most important time to do that.
The most important time, because all the love, I say the nurturing, healing love that we give out, we get back.
I know. But it is a paradox, or I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it is those times when people are anxious and fearful and grieving feeling rejected, that their attention goes completely inward. Right. And I love your idea that, like, I agree, by the way, gratitude is, and I think this happened since you had a conversation with Marty, there was a very large study looking at everything that has been tried for increasing happiness. And the scientists concluded that, first of all, most things don't have a lot of evidence. Doesn't mean they don't work, but they're just not enough to, but then they said, well, what do we really know? And they said, gratitude works. Mm-hmm. And if I recall correctly, relationships, right? Like authentically, and you know, you've been talking about that, you know, this whole conversation. And I do think what gratitude is noticing what you've been given. It's paying attention. You know, if optimism is paying attention to what you can change, gratitude is paying attention to positive things that you have been given by another person, by the world. And I completely agree that is why, I mean, that's been my instinct. That's why it's so powerful. Like, you know, and it like kind of pulls you out of the unhappiness trap. And we've all been there, like kind of these spinning sort of like, the more you're unhappy, the more you think of yourself, the more you think of yourself, the more unhappy you are. And you just dig deeper. But I think gratitude is a way to like climb out of that.
It really is. I just found a journal that JT, my older son, who was 12 years old, he and I started a journal maybe days after the tragedy, where he, right before bed, he would write three things that he was grateful for. I would write three things, but they had to be different every day. Yeah. And I completely forgot that we did that. And then finding it recently, looking at the things that we had to be grateful for during the darkest time of our lives. And there was so much. And that was really something that fortified us. I like to say fortified us from the inside out. Really, really powerful. And then I want to go to, so we have how to develop grit from the inside out. We have interest, we have practice, we have meaning and purpose, and then hope, right? Hope, which defines every stage of grit. This helps us overcome doubts. And I say that this relates to forgiveness. Forgiveness is it's actually our third character value, and it's in order. So courage, gratitude, forgiveness, compassion, and action. But the forgiveness is when we let our pain go. You know, we hold on to pain. I mean, people, things happen in our childhood and we hold on to that pain sometimes for the rest of our life. And it really limits and inhibits us. And so I saw that forgiveness was related to hope, because if we forgive, if we choose to let it go, then we return our locus of control inside of us, where we have the freedom and confidence to do what's necessary to create a better future, which is the definition of hope. And I will say that, you know, I got a lot of attention for forgiving Adam Lanza, the young man who murdered Jesse. And at the time, however, you know, it was almost instinctual, because I knew that somebody that could do something so heinous must have been in a tremendous amount of pain. And I got curious about what that point of pain was. And I found that absolutely, he had been bullied, he had been neglected. And I could tell you stories, Angela, and you would, you know, even if you were, you know, one of the people that, you know, a lot of people like to label people that do something so heinous as evil and monstrous and kind of write them off in that ultimate judgment as if they're not human. But in actuality, we're all human. I feel like there are only two kinds of humans. There are good humans, good humans like you and I, we're trying to figure it out and serve in the best capacity. And then there are good humans in pain. Hmm. And that's exactly what Adam Lanza was. So that's why I forgave him, because I knew that he was in pain. I had actually gone through a relatively similar journey as his mom, and he had, trying to get help at school. So I knew that she was doing the best that she could with the skills and tools that she had. And there was so much blame going towards them. But I thought, wow, you know, if it really was all their fault, this, and of course, yeah, you know, total responsibility, I'm not taking that away, but it yeah would never have happened before and it would never happen again. But wait a minute, it has. So the blame thing didn't really work for me. And I felt compassion that helped me move towards forgiveness. But what I've learned after having embedded forgiveness as one of the character values in all of our programming, all of the decades of research behind the benefits, and one of the main benefits of forgiveness is healthy relationships.
Yes.
And we know healthy relationships, as you just said, are the key to happiness. Yeah. How do we get them? We get them through being able to forgive and understanding that that forgiveness is not a gift that you give somebody else. It's a gift that you give yourself.
How do you, when you are talking to young children, how do you explain what forgiveness means?
That's a really good question. And we do, we have forgiveness in pre-K all the way up to 12th grade. And let me just say, before I explain, it blows my mind, but I ask kids frequently, what's your favorite character value? And I'll never forget being outside of fifth grade class and all these boys it's the last day of school and they're running around. They're so happy and they're kind of being rambunctious. And I have this band here that I'm passing out and it has the character values on it. So I'm giving it away and I go, what's your favorite character value? And they're like, forgiveness. And I'm like,
really?
Yeah, really?
That surprises me. Yeah.
I would not have thought that.
Yeah.
And I said, why is it forgiveness? And they said, because it's like a superpower. It feels so good to let it go.
Wow.
And these kids, that it's the character value they practice the most every day. And it's like, wow, because the advice that I got was not to put forgiveness in the formula because that was too lofty an idea and concept for kids.
Like, right. It's kind of like my question, like, do kids get it? Is it too abstract? Is it too lofty?
Right.
But these kids fully are getting it. Like,
they get it so much that they practice it every day. And the thing is, it does feel good. You know, unless you forgive, you're carrying some sort of baggage around. And we have there are different ways of practicing that. Like we literally have them carrying books or attaching each other with a string and then trying to go different ways. And you can't, obviously, because you're attached to the person.
To other people.
And, you know, if that person hurts you, you are attached to them because they have control over what you're thinking, and what you're thinking impacts what you're feeling, and what you're feeling determines how you behave and show up in relationships. So how do you get away from that person that hurt you? Well, you can use scissors. And of course the teacher uses the scissors, brings out
very good visual. Yeah.
And it's a choice, right? No, and we literally have them do that. The teacher comes out, she cuts the cord that attaches us to pain. And now these kids, they're free and they can do what they want. I remember being in California and it was a whole school. So kindergarten through 12th grade, one person per grade level. And I went down with a mic and I said, what's your favorite character value? 9 out of 10 said forgiveness, which is
That blows my mind.
What? Because courage? You would think courage, or maybe even compassion, because compassion feels good, or maybe gratitude, but no, it was forgiveness. It was so
that
amazing.
Is really interesting, Scott. I had no idea. I would never guess that.
Yeah.
So interesting. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense when you say it, but I'm glad you can I ask you also why you chose the word character? Because I like the word character, as I think you know. I don't think everybody likes the word character. To some people, it just sounds like, I don't know, old fashioned or political, but you chose character values for a reason, I guess. You didn't choose something else.
certain people call them different things, you know.
Yeah.
This program will come into a school and they will, maybe some of them say pillars of the formula, but I like character because I think maybe because there is just a lot of history with character and the concept of character. And I think we've moved away from that. And I think that we need to move back to it. And my whole thing is that I, when I started this process at 44 years old, my son's just been murdered. I see his message of nurturing, healing, love. And I just want to, I know that that's my mission by seeing it. I know that I am supposed to enhance this in schools. So I don't know how. I take it to a doctoral professor who's still on my board. And he was the director of the Compassion, Creativity, and Innovation Center. He had just gotten $1 million from the Dalai Lama. And he lived in my backyard. So I, in a community next to mine, let me be more
specific. Metaphorically.
And I said, so how do I amplify this message into schools? I don't even know. Like, I'm just a mom. I'm not an educator. I have no idea. And he said, social emotional learning. And so I'd never heard of it. He goes, go.
Right. I wondered why you didn't call it social emotional learning, but keep going.
Yeah, right. Well, I went and we have that aspect as well, but I looked that up and I thought, I don't have these skills and tools. I don't have them myself. Mm. And so I went to the curriculum director at Sandy Hook Elementary School. I was breathless. I was like, have you ever heard of this thing called social emotional learning? She's like, yeah. And I said, well, what happened? And she said, well, I spent so much money on a program that we couldn't afford to train the teachers. So it never got out of the box. And so I was like, okay, that's my call to action. And I see that it branded on my brain. And I literally said, okay, I'm going to build a program because this is so important. I don't know this stuff. But if I did, and listen, if Adam Lanza had access to these skills and tools, I know he would not have
done if he had access to gratitude and forgiveness and compassion.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
He had known that pain has a purpose in our lives. It's there to help us grow. You know, you look at it in a different way. I didn't know that either. So, so I built the Choose Love movement and then I made it free because I thought, you know what? Every child needs access to this, every single child on the planet. And, you know, this is in their best interest. We are responsible for their safety, health, and well-being. This is addressing the root cause. We can reduce and prevent the suffering before it ever leads to not only violence, but substance abuse and mental health issues. If we can do this. So that's been, you know, I've just been so grateful for this mission and on it 24/7 for the last 11 years. And it's been really just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, no, I resonate with everything you've said. And, you know, for those who want to call this category of things something other than care, but I resonated with that terminology. You said something a few minutes ago that I know we're you know, close to the end of the conversation, but I just want to say that when you said that it feels better to choose love and to be, you know, forgiving. And so I agree with that. I think one of the challenges though, is that when you feel hurt and aggrieved and rejected, there is an immediate gratification from hating back, from hitting back. Mm-hmm. And so you have a competition between two things that are going to make you feel better. One is choosing love and kindness and grace and forgiveness and courage. And that will ultimately make you feel a lot better for a lot longer. But there is this kind of like, I could just hit you back. I could spit back. I could hate you back. I could reject you back. And I think the problem is that like that, which is not going to make anybody feel better for long, is kind of the easy, immediate thing.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, you know, why you're talking about these skills, which I completely agree. I think somehow, like, I think there are a lot of people who don't think it's appropriate to bring these things into pre-K to 12 education. I'm with you. I'm like, what are we teaching our kids if we can't, you know, if we're not preparing them for life and to be better people?
I mean, here's the thing. If they're being taught this at home, that's fantastic. I know that I didn't have these skills and tools. I loved my kids. I wanted to do what was best for them, but I couldn't give them what I didn't have. But the thing is, we practice these skills and tools every day, all day long. So it can't be that they learn them at home and there's a void in school. You still have to have grit in school when you're doing academics. You still have to have forgiveness and gratitude and all these other things every single day, all day long. Choosing love over fear is a choice that you make. It doesn't matter what environment you're in. And we know that it's, as you say, practice, practice, practice for mastery. And so we need to practice this every day, all day long. And so, you know, and here's the thing, you know, I do address that. I talk about how the brain wants to keep us safe. So if you, you know, run into somebody and they give you a dirty look at the grocery store or something, you know, your brain activates. I think, you know, we talk about emotional management a lot, but I see it more as emotions are something that's evolutionary, and that immediate red cheek, the hair on the back of your neck, and that I call it the figurative dukes that your brain puts up to protect you. That's just your brain's way of protecting you. And you can't really control that. It just happens. But what you can do is pause, and we have a choice moment. Pause and get curious. So I'm in the groceries because all this data is being filtered through your fear center first, and your fear center is four times faster than your prefrontal cortex at processing. So you get that dirty look, that's going into your fear center, and you are going to react. This initial reaction out of habit or memory. And so you have your figurative dukes up already, but then you pause. This gives your prefrontal cortex time to come online where that brake on your instinctual response is, and you get curious and you think, wow, I don't even know this person. And this person is, you know, like staring me up and down. I don't even know her. I wonder what happened to her. And, you know, it's like driving down the road with my 23-year-old son and somebody cut us off and he starts, getting really angry, right? And I'm like, you know what? You don't know that that person isn't going to visit their dying mother in the hospital. And he goes, but you don't know that they are. And why would you make up that story? And I said, because that story serves me. And then I can control my state. I don't give them power over me. They're not making me upset. I give them grace to go by. And so that works for me, but we have the power to do that. If we pause, get curious, because there's always a point of pain. I tell the kids, if somebody's not being nice to you, you know, we work a lot with bullying behavior. I don't like to label kids bullies. I don't like that at all, but the behavior can be like that. And if somebody's not being nice to you, how are they feeling? Not good, right? And if they're not feeling good, how do you thoughtfully respond to them? Because you have a choice. You always have a choice. You can react, or how would you thoughtfully respond? Well, we could ask them what's wrong. Yeah, exactly.
Right. That's actually with curiosity.
Kids get it quicker than big kids. You know what I mean?
I believe you. I do. I believe you, which is why I am so glad you're working, you know, at all levels. You know, pre-K was what, 3-4 years old that you must be working with? And then all the way up to the big kids are 18. But everything you've said, in this conversation, Scarlett, has resonated very deeply with me.
Well, and you too. Thank you for the gift to the world that you are, and all of your research. So amazing. I'm just so honored to have you on the Choose Love podcast. Thank you so much. Is there any last kind of words of wisdom that you'd like to leave?
Well, I'll say this, I am writing another book, and it's only because of some of the things that you brought up. Scarlett, I think that it's not like grit just is, you know, some people have it and some people don't. I think that when people develop character values like grit and kindness and compassion and forgiveness, it is because they have had the benefit of, you know, being with, wise adults and in, you know, classrooms that are caring themselves and so forth. So I just couldn't believe more in what you're doing. And if you ask me, like, well, what's your book about? It's like basically that in a nutshell. I do believe that we need to think about the circumstances that enable us to develop character. Like, what are the crucibles of character? And like you, I think that, tragedies are preventable. They don't just happen. We don't just have to react to them. So anyway, it's been an honor to be in conversation. I really believe in the mission of what you're doing.
Thank you so much. That means the world to me. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will see you next time. Thank you.
Hey, hey, oh, it's all part of us. We can all choose love. It'll lift you up if you let it in. Let the healing